It's Wednesday, June 5th, 2019, and this is KBIA's News of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Kathy Kiley and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, could we see the eventual breakup of Facebook, Google, and other tech giants? We'll talk about plans to start a bipartisan antitrust investigation in the U.S. House. Rest in peace, iTunes. Apple announced at Monday's WWDC conference that one of its first apps is going away. How will Apple distribute music, movies, TV, and podcasts? And I want to ask Ernest and Kathy about the end of last week's Scripps spelling bee.
Odilic. O-D-Y-L-I-C. Odilic.
You are correct.
8 champions? Did the kids finally beat the dictionary? There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before our half hour is up today. But we're going to start with a decision made in a story published over the weekend by the Daily Beast. Remember this video of Nancy Pelosi? Take a listen. The first half is what she said. The second, the digitally manipulated version that spread on social media, a deep fake meant to make it sound like she was drunk.
And then he had a press conference in the Rose Garden with all this short sort of visuals that obviously were planned long before. And then he had a press conference in the Rose Garden with all this short sort of visuals that obviously were planned long before.
So Saturday, the Daily Beast published a story identifying the producer of that video as a 34-year-old day worker from the Bronx, characterizing him as a Donald Trump super fan and occasional sports blogger. They mentioned his name, too, and the story went on calling him, quote, a proud member of Trump's razor-thin African-American support base. Also mentioned he's on probation for domestic violence charges against an ex-girlfriend. So I want to ask you, was publishing this thing in the way that the Daily Beast did with this level of detail, was it fair?
Well, I'm not sure. The level of detail, I'm not sure about. I mean, I don't have a problem with them saying that, you know, he's connected to Trump or he's a Trump supporter. I don't even, you know, the whole razor-thin African-American.
That's editorializing.
You're right. The things about the charges against him and that sort of thing, I don't think that's relevant to what they're doing. But what really interests me in all of this is a sort of backlash that that's occurred in terms of whether or not he should have been, you know, outed, whether or not they did it in the correct way. What do you do if it's someone on the liberal side that does something similar? Are they going to receive the same kind of treatment? I thought that was an interesting sort of back and forth to what's going on here.
The editor, Kathy, of the Daily Beast had kind of defended this decision to go to the lengths it did, saying that Rudy Giuliani himself had gone ahead and tweeted out this video, had put it out there and furthered its exposure. And if those at the highest levels of power are going to do so, it had an obligation to go ahead and provide information about its provenance and its origins. Would you agree with that statement?
Yeah, I would differ a little bit with Ernest here. I think, I think this is a hard lesson for people to learn. There's an earlier example of this that happened way, way back in the early 2000s with John Siegenthaler, the now late editor of the Nashville paper, who was also slandered on the internet, also by somebody who was kind of a nebbishy guy, you know, and that guy was outed too. I think one of the things that we try to educate people to, our students, but also I think adults out there, is that anybody who has a cell phone now, a smartphone, is a publisher. Time to learn to be reporters. Time to learn the responsibilities that go with the privilege of being able to publish. And it's a hard lesson for an individual like that to learn. But at the same time, you just can't slander people. Our journalism students know that. But the odd thing now is that technology has really put that power of publication into everybody's hands. And so I really think that we need to be teaching those lessons more broadly to the community because what this guy did was terribly wrong and terribly damaging politically, and he's paying a price. And I think there are people, and I probably am among them, who think, yeah, he should be.
Well, I'm not. Let me back up a second here. I'm not against him being outed. I don't have a problem with the fact that, you know, that they actually published a story. They published his name. They said that he manipulated it. They even talked about how he manipulated it. That I don't have a problem. Whether you're talking about right, left, center, whatever, if you're going to put the information out there, then you need to own it. And so I have no problem with that. And maybe by them doing this, more of them will... Either they'll stop, or they will. At least they will know this is what can happen if you put this out there. So I don't have a problem with that. I think what little concerned me a little bit was, okay, you put out this, you know, the information you put out about a charge against them that came from the past, and maybe the person who was involved in that, then they get dragged into it. That's the portion that I have a problem with.
Well, yeah, and I think too. Again, this gets to, and this is another. Effect of the internet, but this emphasis on snark. So mm-hmm. I would just say, you've got a good story. You did some great reporting, Daily Beast. You don't need to be snarky about it. Just the facts. Yeah.
So, Kathy, I also want to talk to you for a minute, because there's another angle to this video as well. And you wrote a piece in the opinion section of the USA Today, something that you do from time to time in your role here as the Lee Hills Chair for Free Press Studies here at the School of Journalism, about this video and what needed to be done from a publishing standpoint, kind of pointing fingers at Facebook about this a little bit.
Yeah, well, I think the problem here is that, and, you know, we're talking a little bit about these internet giants and the effort to break them up. I think one of the reasons that there's such anger here is that for years, the internet publishing moguls have wanted the fun of being a publisher to be able to put all that information out there without the responsibility, without vetting. And so really, and what was really disgraceful, I thought, about Facebook is that once this video, this fake video, was pointed out to them, they took this really, if I can use the New Testament here, Pontius Pilate attitude of let's wash our hands of it. Oh, well, yes, you know, we know that's fake, but we can't really take it down. Well, why not? You know, you're a publisher. But the internet providers for years have not wanted to be publishers because that would mean taking responsibility for the content on their sites. They have not wanted to do that. There's a congressional law that was passed in the 1990s, that a provision of a law that exempts them from many of the same responsibilities that other publishers would have. And I think we're coming to the end of that line there.
I think that's an area where you and I agree. They've never really wanted that responsibility. And part of it was they would say, well, by us not having this responsibility, this opens it up to individuals to be able to publish and to put out there what they see fit and to share and that sort of thing. This sort of laissez-faire, you know, open market kind of philosophy. Well, there's still a responsibility there. If you can, and you do have control over that, you have had the ability from its inception to allow things on and to take things off, and you've used it at your discretion. Now, where they're getting a lot of pushback, not only from governmental entities, but from consumer advocates, from individuals, now all of a sudden they're having to figure out, okay, how do we try to self-regulate this so that we don't have to face governmental regulation, which I think is on the horizon.
I do too. And I think even beyond what's happening in the United States, which, you know, we're rightly concerned about political fakery and propaganda, but the propaganda is having a much more horrific effect overseas, where you see in cases like Myanmar and other foreign countries where these platforms have been used to spread lies, to spread, to really foment violence against groups, and not taking responsibility for the platform you own and the power that you have, I think, is really, it's immoral.
So let's talk about this for a second. We were talking about some of those issues with the tech giants. And a little bit earlier this week, we found that the stock prices for both Facebook and for Google, they took a hit upon news that the Department of Justice and members of the U.S. House are preparing antitrust investigations into those companies. One member of the House's top antitrust subcommittee has said these companies are being looked at because, in his words, the internet is broken.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about the internet being broken. I think that's a little hyperbole, but I do think that there is this, and we just alluded to it, there's this lack of responsibility on the part of these huge corporations to deal with the issue of their basically, you know, their operations being utilized by people who are fermenting propaganda that is violent, that's sexist, that's racist, that also in many ways are perpetuating fraud. We haven't even talked about what happens economically on Facebook and Google that actually affects people's pocketbooks because of fraud issues. So I think that's, you have those companies are being hit on all sides, not just by those who want to have some sort of regulation on the type of content, but those who also want them to take responsibility for many of the economic problems that they have that they've caused as well. And let's not forget about Amazon and all the others that are also being lumped into this as well.
Data has become a monopoly for some of these companies. And it's interesting, you know, we hear a lot, certainly in our region of the country, of concerns by gun owners that, you know, what if the government takes away my guns and my ammo and you couldn't have a revolution? The real thing people should be worrying about, in my opinion, is their data. Information is power, and when you have that much power concentrated in the hands of one or two or three companies that are, at this point, effectively unregulated, it's a dangerous thing. And I think our government, our democracy, has been built on the idea of checks and balances on power, and I think you're now getting to a point where you see the political system saying, wait a minute, there's too much power concentrated here.
And that's actually a question, you used the word monopoly, and that's actually a question that I put to students in the master's course that I teach in online audience development, that's based on a report that was done on 60 Minutes maybe about 6 or 8 months ago about Google. And the basic question was, is Google a monopoly? Looking at, not only is it the search engine that has become, you know, the ubiquitous term for using search, but it's now, you know, it owns YouTube. It's the Google apps suite that I work on projects on an hourly basis, where my data, again, is all being stored on Google servers, even though I want to think it's mine and it's safe. Or how quickly the Google Apps for Classroom or Google Classroom has moved into schools on all levels, or the idea of Google's Chromebooks literally being handed to school districts for free,
right,
and being put into children's hands. The Android platform for cell phones and tablets.
I mean, you know, everything that you highlighted.
And that's probably only a part of it.
That's only a part, but it all points to, is it a monopoly? Is it too big to fail? What happens if someone, some nefarious operation gets its hands on?
And how
even
do we know that Google
portion?
Isn't nefarious at some point?
Well, absolutely. I mean, here's the thing. Here in the United States, our governmental regulators and others have been slow to act. The EU has been on this for almost a decade, and they are basically saying to Google, we're going to figure out a way to either regulate you, to break you apart. We're late to the game. As we were, as a resident historian here, we had the same issues when it came to the oil companies. We had the same issues when it came to telephone, AT&T. I mean, everybody remembers the whole breakup of AT&T and how that happened. We may be at the point where that process is beginning with the internet, in which the regulators, the government, and consumers are going to step in and say, wait a minute, we want to have more control over our information, as you were talking about, Kathy. We want to be able to secure that, and we also want to open it up for others and not have it be controlled by these basic conglomerates.
Well, and I think the other insidious thing there is the drive to maintain audience and to get advertising creates this effect that it may not be intended to be nefarious, but it is. People want you, and this is one of the things I talk to students about a lot, and I'm sure you do too. People want you to stay on their website, and so
they're only
going to give you information that they think you're already interested in. So if you shop at Cabela's and you're a hunter and you live in a certain zip code, you're going to get some certain kinds of information and certain kinds of news feeds. And if you live in Manhattan and buy the New Yorker, it's going to be something different. Well, how do we ever reach a compromise as a country, or how do we ever have our received ideas questioned if we're getting spoon-fed things that some algorithm thinks we will enjoy?
It gives you a sense of control when, in fact, they're controlling you.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. Exactly. And I think that's really an education process for consumers, but I do think it's also going to have to require some regulation.
Okay, so yesterday morning, there was a great tease on the Today Show. Savannah Guthrie said something about Apple's announcement from Monday's Worldwide Developers Conference that it's the end for iTunes. Craig Melvin, apparently a newsman not quite up on the news, gasped and uttered an audible, "What?" It's true. After 18 years, Apple is killing off the music, podcast, TV, movies, and books and device backup app. Okay, so maybe iTunes, knowing that it does all of those things, has become a little bit bloated in the 18 years that it's been on our devices.
Well, when I told my wife, who, you know, she basically lives, her music lives in iTunes. The first thing she said was, "Well, what about my music? What's going to happen with my music?" So I'm trying to explain it to her. She still didn't quite get it, but you know, this was coming. I mean, for the last several cycles, you know, as some of the Apple people put it, in the last several cycles, the only place you had iTunes was on their actual computers. They're not on the phones anymore. They're not on the iPads anymore, because they've already transitioned them to the music icon and the App Store and video and that sort of thing. So they're separate. So it's one of those things where it's evolved, and we as consumers have to move on, because the company that controls it, as we were just talking about a minute ago, is basically dictating that
it's
we're going to move on. So that's right. Pretty much where we are.
This could be another boom for vinyl, you know? People really want, like your wife,
back.
Really want to own
back.
Their...
It's coming back. We have a
well,
bunch
I
of
do think there's a movement towards analog. It's interesting. But I actually think this might be a good thing for those of us in the news media, because... what Apple is doing is pushing customers towards a subscription model. And that's certainly what we could, we'd like people to do in terms of getting their news. And I think what Apple did with creating iTunes was really create a platform that encouraged people not to be a pirate.
Right, and, iTunes basically killed file transfer sites like Napster.
Yeah, exactly.
Going back 18 years ago or so, because that idea of the micropayment of buying a single song for 99 cents.
Yeah.
That 99 cents seemed somewhat negligible.
Yeah.
It seemed benign or negligible in that idea. And it was like, well, for 99 cents, I'll buy it, as opposed to just pirating it.
And I think the competition that Apple is getting from various streaming services.
I'll admit, I subscribe to Spotify to get that for $4.99
a month. Absolutely. I mean, you got Spotify, you got Pandora, you've got Netflix, you've got Hulu. I mean, you've got all of these streaming services, and they're trying to figure out how do we compete with that, which doesn't fit with what they had traditionally done with iTunes.
And add Amazon Prime to that, where not only do you get the video and you get the audio, because Amazon Music becomes part of that, you get your 2-day free shipping.
Yep.
So every once in a while, we have a story to talk about where a document never meant to be made public was, and that's usually because a government employee somewhere filed it or classified it incorrectly. Well, it's happened again, and now near Pittsburgh, there's a radio reporter who is being blocked from using the information he has gotten about a shale gas settlement. Kathy, you brought this to our attention. Tell us what's going on out
there. I love this story, and in fact, there was a late development yesterday where the company involved, the fracking company, kind of said uncle and told the judge they wouldn't oppose the release of the information, and so the reporter is now allowed to report the information that he obtained fair and square from a public-facing website paid for by the taxpayers of Washington County, PA. But what I thought was interesting about this story is how repeatedly we see this happen. What was happening here is what is known in the business as prior restraint, an effort by a judge, a legal entity, to say, yes, we know you have that information to a reporter, but you
and
can't.
And yes, we know that you obtained it legally. And it was kind of sort of the government's fault that you got it.
Exactly. And interestingly, there have been a number of these cases, but one of the things that was argued before the judge in Pennsylvania, the lawyer for the radio reporter, a guy named Reed Frazier, was the reporter involved. His lawyer said the First Amendment protects publication of lawfully obtained information on matters of public concern, and cited the famous New York Times Pentagon Papers case. But despite that strong precedent, it happens a lot. And one case that our listeners may be familiar with involves Parkland. There was a report that was issued involving the school district's interaction with the shooter in that case. And part of it was supposed to be redacted. It wasn't. It was posted publicly. The Sun Sentinel newspaper wrote about it and won a Pulitzer Prize. And it took a year before the case was dismissed. So there are multiple cases. I've got a whole page here just within the last year where the government will make something available and then tries to claw it back. And I think what's interesting here is it's always public information. It's public data that was acquired by a government entity, which is paid for by the taxpayers, and the government saying, no, you didn't see that, it wasn't here. And it's just amazing how often this happens, despite these strong legal precedents.
Okay. Well, so in another one of those, the times they are a-changing moments, the end of last Thursday's Scripps National Spelling Bee.
Odilic. O-D-Y-L-I-C, Odilic.
It's complete.
You're all champions of the 2019 Scripps National Spelling Bee. They will forever be remembered as the Elite Eight, the eight spellers that for 3.5 hours took the best punch the dictionary had to throw at them. And this is the night, Paul Loeffler, that the kids won the spelling bee.
Okay, so that might have been the most dramatic call ever, especially for a sporting event that didn't really have the agony of defeat, except maybe for Simone Kaplan. She was the last speller eliminated. Before the eight finalists each spelled their final word correctly, and the judges cried uncle. Both of my parents thought that this was the sweetest thing ever. Mine was kind of one of indignance. Like, how do you have eight spelling bee champions? You keep spelling till one of you wins that thing.
I have one word. What? Television.
That's
we were running out of time. We can't keep going. We're 3 hours in. There's no end in sight. We got another show to put on.
That was exactly what my dad tried to say to me. That here you've got ESPN. You've got its flagship network right at this point. We're in the height of the NFL playoff, or the NFL championships are going on. The NHL championships are going on. It's Major League Baseball season. Here it is almost midnight, and you've got a bunch of tween-age kids that are up and still spelling that they've been doing for how many hours at a time? It was time to get back to sports.
Well, yeah, you know, I think we had game one of the NBA
finals.
Going on. We got to keep.
Oh, they could have moved it over to ESPN2. Come on. No, I think, you know, the interesting thing is I don't know what it says about our orthography as a country, but even here at the. Yes, I can.
Okay. We're talking about the spelling bee.
Right. And what I want to say, I don't want to run out of time, but
we're good. I'm watching the time.
Okay. All right. O-R-T-H-O. Anyway, it's that we had at Missouri, we had our Columbia Missourian sponsored regional spelling bee, and it too went on forever and ever. And it was just, it was amazing. These kids are so prepared.
And that's what makes me wonder. Like, have we beaten the dictionary? Have we gotten to a point that with these kids who are learning the origins, that they're learning the definitions of the root words? In some cases, they have coaches. Has the spelling bee, after 92 years, has it run its course? And do we maybe need to find some other kind of nerdy academic competition to replace it?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I like the nostalgia of it. I mean, if it happens,
well, that's 'cause we had spelling bees.
If it repeatedly happens, yeah. I mean, like, say if you had, you know, like 5 years in a row where you have five or more champions and you have to sort of call it quits after 3.5-4 hours, then you might have a problem with the dictionary being, you know, broken. But I don't think we're at that point yet.
I think the judges are broken. But I will say this, that the same judges come to Washington every year and do a spelling bee at the National Press Club where it's the press versus the politicians. And we never go that long. None of us are that good.
Okay, so we do now have about a minute and a half or so to talk about this one. For so many of us, the trivia show Jeopardy has been that nerdy academic outlet, and it looked like there were going to be some records broken Monday until this happened.
That takes him to 24,799. So, Emma, it's up to you. If you came up with a correct response, you're going to be the new Jeopardy champion. Did you? You did. What did you wager? Oh, God. 20,000. What a payday. 46,801. What a game. Oh, my God.
So 32 games straight he had won, and there was belief that based on his patterns, he was likely to break Ken Jennings' record on Monday. In fact, he made that much smaller than anticipated wager on Final Jeopardy, and it was all over.
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering, why did he bet so low?
Because television, Ernest. Isn't that what you were just saying a couple minutes ago?
Yeah, but... But you're going to break the record. I mean, you know, go for it. I mean, you're a gambler. That's the other thing. He's a gambler.
He looked kind of relieved to me. He looked kind of relieved when
he high-fived. So you think he planned it?
Yeah, I think maybe he was ready to cash in.
That maybe it was time for him to say, enough already?
Right. But maybe. He did it before he breaking the record.
Yeah.
And that's not generally what a gambler does. You know, they're going for it. So that's why I was a little confused.
So there was a lot of excitement about this, and there were a lot of people who were watching. I had gotten several email notifications, push notifications during the course of the day on Monday that something could be happening. There were some criticisms about the potential spoilers that were out there.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of traffic out there about don't spoil it for people who want to see it at their normal time, you know, that sort of thing. And in fact, I mean, I think it had gotten out that he had lost from someone within the Jeopardy universe who had sent it out, and they did this investigation, and apparently they found out who it was. So, I mean, and I haven't been able to check to see what happened to this person, but there was a lot of angst about what was happening there.
Well, game shows are important, right? I think that you know, it's kind of cool that we've done these two segments on these two really nerdy, education-oriented events at
Kathy,
a time
come
when we
hang
just
out
think,
at the table
oh,
with me. I always try to find something nerdy to make it fun. Well, we are just about out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about today on our Links blog. That's under both the podcast and programs tabs at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.